It's no secret that marriages are not doing well. If you believe the statistics, the divorce rate is about 50% in the United States. By the way, just as I can't resist this because my training is in logic. Do you know how they calculate the divorce rate? You take the number of marriages last year, and you take the number of divorces last year, and you divide. And that's the divorce rate. Does that sound nuts? That's nuts. That doesn't say anything about the viability of marriages over the next 20 or 30 years. It really doesn't say anything about the probability of your marriage. If you just have an increasing or decreasing population, you'll change the divorce statistic just because of that. It's really a little nutty. But I guess what else can you do? What other number can you calculate that's precise and in the same subject? But it's not good. It's not good. And some marriages that don't divorce ought to, but don't because of a lack of resources or courage. In general, marriage is not doing well. And this in a generation that is, on the whole, better educated, more widely traveled, more experienced than perhaps any other generation in history. One might have thought that all that education and all that experience would make for more successful marriages. And yet it does not seem to be working that way. And the traditional Jewish community, though it does have its problems, maybe an 8% divorce rate, still, that's spectacularly better than the average of the larger population. So the traditional mode of life is certainly doing better, much better than the average, and therefore it would be wise to investigate the conceptions of love and marriage in traditional Judaism so we may get some insight into its relative success. For this purposes, you don't have to lock yourself up in a cave someplace and spend the rest of your time meditating on the Mishnah. I know what ultra-Orthodox means. Some people who follow the commandments of the Torah. So, okay. That's what it's loosely called Orthodox. The first description of the relationship between husband and wife is Isaac and Rebekah. Abraham sends his servant Eliezer to find a wife for Isaac, and he does so, accompanied by miraculous signs. He brings her back to Israel, and it says that Isaac took her into the tent of Sarah, his mother, and he married her, and he loved her. Now, there's something very strange there. First of all, the order. He married her first and loved her second. That doesn't fit the contemporary paradigm. And then he took her into the tent of Sarah, his mother. What was this, a tour of the premises? What exactly does that mean? The rabbis explain as follows. As long as Sarah was alive, her tent had three distinguishing marks. When she lit the lamps Friday afternoon, they burned to the following Friday afternoon. And when she made a dough, even a small portion could completely satisfy a person's hunger. And there was a cloud attached to her tent. These three signs also were found in the tabernacle. They were visible signs of God's presence. When she died, these signs disappeared. Even though Abraham was still alive. So when Isaac met Rebekah, his question to her was, can you do what my mother did? Can you create an environment in which the Shekhinah, God's presence, will show itself visibly? He took her into the tent of Sarah, his mother. And when she demonstrated that she could do that, he married her, and love was the result, not the precondition. Here's the general rule. The decision to marry is based on two evaluations. Do we share the same values, same goals, the same worldview? Is one. Are we suited to one another? To live together with one another and share those goals and those values. That's number two. And number three is the commitment of marriage. The absolute commitment to the relationship. And love grows out of the three of those together. That's the formula. Now, in the next generation, Jacob, you have what appears to be a contrasting scenario. Jacob leaves home because his parents have told him to find a wife, and he's also running away from his older brother who wants to kill him. Comes to his extended family in Syria, comes to the well at the outskirts of the town, and he sees the girls of the town with the flocks, and one of them is his cousin, and he runs over to her and gives water to the sheep and kisses her and weeps. Ah, now I can see the Hollywood version. Yeah. Comes over the hill, the verdant valley laid out in front of him, the beautiful maiden, love at first sight, instant infatuation. Well, let's see. Let's continue the story and see if that's the right meaning. He takes up residence with his uncle. His uncle says, "You shouldn't work for me for nothing. Name your wages." Jacob says, "I'll serve you 7 years for the right to marry Rachel, the younger daughter." Now, we should ask, is this a normal transaction? That a man gives up 7 years' wages for the right to marry a woman? Wasn't it usually the parents of the girl who provided a dowry for the bride? And in 7 years, an arbitrary choice could have just as well have been 132 months or 2,000 days. Put those questions on hold. We'll come back to them. Now, the Torah says that the years went by, the years went by as but a few days due to his love of her. They just zipped by because of his love for her. One of the most romantic statements in the entire Bible. But does it make any sense? Suppose you want something. You're longing for something. And it's some time away. How does the time pass? Quickly or slowly? Think of summer vacation. Right? How do the last 4 weeks go? Just zipping by? Every day drags because it's something that you want and it's taking time. So why would the Torah say that 7 years went by as but a few days due to his love of her? But I will hold back to that also. Finally, the Torah says, Jacob confronts his uncle and tells him, "Give me my wife, for the time has been fulfilled, and I will go in unto her." Now that statement is gross. Not I say so, but the rabbis say so. Afilu Kalashi Bakalanina Omer King, the most light-headed, degraded personality, does not express himself in that way. What could Jacob have meant? And in the answer to that question, we'll have the answers to the other questions as well. The Talmud tells us that Jacob was the choicest, the most superior of all the patriarchs. Why? One symptom is this. Abraham had non-Jewish children. How many? At least 7. Ishmael before Isaac was born. After Sarah died, he took another wife and had 6 more sons, all of whom were lost to the Jewish people. Isaac had the twins. Jacob and Esau. Esau was lost. Jacob is the first, all of whose children remain within the Jewish people. It means Abraham and Isaac are ancestors of the Jewish people. Jacob and his family are the Jewish people. That's why the name of the people is taken from Jacob. Israel is Jacob's other name. Now, this challenge, the challenge to build Jewish people in your family, is a challenge that was not given to his father or grandfather. It was given first to Jacob. And he knows that this is his challenge. Now, how do you build a family? You build a family through sexual relations. That's the way God created the world. If God created it that way, there cannot be anything degraded, evil, substandard, rejected in that aspect of life. That aspect of life, like everything else in life, is inherently neutral, and it becomes what you make out of it. It can be a means of dominating another person, or just seeking personal pleasure, or a means of communication, commitment, and expression of love. It all depends on what you make out of it. For Jacob, it's going to be the means through which he will bring the Jewish people into the world. For him, it becomes holy of holies. That's why he has no hesitation in mentioning it to his uncle. And now, with that in mind, let's go back to the questions that are on hold. Jacob wants 7 years. 7 units of time in our sources means a complete period of time, as it is in the 7 days of the week, the 7 years in the sabbatical year cycle, 7 sabbatical years in the Jubilee cycle, 7 days of Pesach. Oh, I know, you have 8. That's because you live in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. You live outside the land of Israel. If you live where you belong, you'd have 7 days. 7 days of Sukkot, 8 days, a separate holiday. 7 weeks between the first day of Pesach and Shavuos, we count up to 49 days. And 7 units of time connote purification. Contact with the dead body requires a 7-day purification period. So Jacob says, I'm preparing for this challenge, the challenge of building the Jewish people in my family. I want 7 years to prepare. Now, if you are preparing for a test, a challenge, a very difficult challenge, a very important challenge, and you're actively preparing, let's say it's an exam next week, or a big athletic contest, or a dramatic performance, or appearance in court, whatever it is. And you're preparing. How does the time go by? Don't you say, it's Wednesday already? The exam's on Friday. What happens in the week? I've only got 48 hours. When you're preparing for a significant test, time goes by very quickly. And that's why Jacob's years went by quickly, because he was preparing to meet that challenge that his father and grandfather just laid the groundwork for. And now let's go back to the beginning of the story. He comes over the hill and he sees his cousin and he kisses her and he weeps. Of course, weeping doesn't really fit to the Hollywood version. I'm not yet so old that I don't remember what instant infatuation felt like, and I don't remember feeling like crying. But more than that, at this point in his life, Jacob is already a prophet. He's already had the dream of the ladder, with the angels going up and down, and hearing God himself speak to him. When Jacob looks at Rachel, he sees in her the mother of the Jewish people. That's why he instantly commits himself to her. And then, the rule here is the same as the rule of the previous generation. He knows, because he's a prophet, that they share the same goals, same values, same worldview, and that they're suited to one another to live together, to work on those goals, promote those values. And he makes the commitment to her, and from those three, love is the result. That's the first message of love and, well, perhaps I should say love in marriage in Jewish sources. Then there's another idea, which is found in the Talmud, based on a verse in the Torah, which will take us in a different direction altogether. It says in the book of Genesis that God created the human race, male and female, by Yikra Shmom Adam. He called their name Adam. Not his name Adam, their name. And don't tell me that Adam is the name of the species. The species is the Ne'ov, the offspring, the descendants of Adam. The word Adam embraces the two of them, the male and the female together. So the Talmud says either there was a single androgynous. A single androgynous, that's Greek. Well, a single androgynous creation, a male-female amalgam, in all respects, physical, spiritual, emotional, and intellectual. Or it was planned to be so and created separately, afterwards as a separate move. The picture of Adam is a male-female amalgam. That's what Adam is. Later there's a split, for whatever reason. Now, what does that picture teach us? The rule in our sources is, a piece of history is preserved only if it teaches us how to live. Otherwise, let it be cosigned to the oblivion of entropy. What it teaches us at the outset is that every human being is a fragment. No man is human, and no woman is human. Every human being is a fragment. Human being, being humanly, is found only in an appropriate male-female amalgam. And that in marriage, what we are trying to do is approximate, approach as much as possible, that kind of amalgam that was the being of Adam at the outset. What does it mean that we are fragments? And I'll give you two analogies that may help communicate the idea better. If you hear someone speaking on a telephone, what do you hear? Yes, fine, okay. George is coming? Good. 3 o'clock? And don't forget the books. See you. That's not a conversation. It's not a monologue either. You've only heard one half of a dialogue. You don't know what they're talking about. To know, you have to hear the other half of the conversation. If we were in touch with ourselves, if we really felt our essence deeply, we would feel each of us like half a conversation, missing, at least for the time being, the other half. Or, you're listening to a violinist play the violin part of the early Beethoven violin sonatas. Now, if you're listening to it, you don't have to be a great musician to figure out something's funny, because part of the time he's just counting the rest, standing there doing nothing. And the rest of the time, the music doesn't really make sense. It doesn't connect. Right, because we left out the piano. If the violin is playing alone, you're only getting half the music. If we felt ourselves deeply, we would each of us feel himself to be like a violin without a piano, or a piano without a violin. We are essentially incomplete. In marriage, what we are trying to achieve is completeness. Now here's an opportunity to make a great mistake. So let me stop to identify it and correct it. So I'm incomplete, and I get married in order to achieve completeness. Does that mean that when I get married, my wife makes me complete? The answer is no. That's not what it means, and it's not what I said. Let's go back to the music. If the violinist is playing alone, the violin is complete. It has four strings. It has a bow. It has its frets. No, the music is incomplete. And when you add the piano, you don't then finally get a complete violin. You had a complete violin. The completeness is found in the music, and the music embraces the violin and piano together. They together create a new thing. It's the new thing that's complete, and they, the violin and piano, are parts of this new complete thing. So when I get married, it isn't that my wife makes me complete. It's that my wife and I together create a new thing. That new thing is complete, and we are each parts of that new complete thing. Now, it's this idea that I want to try to illustrate for you, both in general, and I'll give you some practical applications, and then we'll have some time for questions. To describe it in general, I want to consider three levels of integration with the goal at the top. Maybe by taking the idea gradually through stages, it will become clearer. The lowest level of integration is what could be called an I plus I relationship. In this relationship, each person is a totally self-interested ego. I want for myself whatever is good for me. But I recognize that you too could be a completely self-interested ego, and that by cooperation, we could each of us get for his own ego more than we could get going it alone. So we form a partnership. This is the foundation of all business partnerships, that each side will make a bigger profit through the partnership. To her everlasting shame, this was Ayn Rand's conception of marriage. Marriage is essentially a business proposition. Each side promises to render certain goods and services to the other. Best to draw up a contract in open court, so that if there's breach of contract, you can sue it in open court. Well, we can do better than that. We can easily understand relationships that have more integration than that. A step up to what could be called a we relationship. In a we relationship, which could be marriage or could be other groups, there is a group and there's a group goal, and each person in the group identifies with the goal of the whole and is willing to sacrifice his own personal advantage for the sake of the whole gaining its success. And I don't think this is utopian. I don't think this is unrealistic. I think everyone here has experienced this. In amateur sports, for example, maybe sometimes in professional sports, but certainly in amateur sports, you play as part of a team. You're trying to win the game. Now let's suppose you're playing soccer, because you haven't yet heard of a real game called football, so you play a cheap game called soccer. Now, the score is tied 2-2. There are 30 seconds left in the game. You're a guard. You have the ball in the enemy territory. And the goal is clear. If you shoot under these conditions, 75% of the time you make the goal. You're a hero. You won the game. But there's a forward clear also, and you could pass it to him. And under these conditions, if you pass it to the forward, he makes the goal 100% of the time. What do you do? Shoot or pass? Many people will pass. Why? Because why should I take any chance of losing the game? So he's sacrificing his glory for the sake of the success of the team. I think you have this in political efforts, and you have this in hospitals, and you have this in music. It's a we relationship where the individuals are prepared to sacrifice for the success of the whole. But it's still several people standing in a relationship. We is a plural pronoun. And the roles are distinguished. When the guard passes and the forward puts in the goal goes on the forward scorecard, and the guard gets credit for a pass. So the roles are distinguished. Each one still has his identity, but he has dedicated his activities to the success of the group. Above that, third step, third position now. Above that, you could have a relationship which could be called a single eye relationship, where the people standing in the relationship share an eye. Not I plus I, but they share a single eye. And this is the other relationship that I want to describe to you. Let me try to make this clear to you with a few analogies. I'm going to introduce to you the first person singular pronoun twice. Here's the first production. I. Here's the second production. Now let's see. What do each of those eyes refer to? Shall we say the first eye refers to my lungs, my larynx, my mouth, because that's what produced it. And the second eye refers to my arm, because my arm produced it. Of course, that's not true. Each eye refers to the whole of me. Even though one was produced by my voice apparatus and the other was produced by my arm. But the eye expands. The eye is limited to what produced it. The eye expands to refer to the whole of me. Even though different parts of me produced it. Now, second illustration. Let's imagine a picture of a room in which you have two chairs and a table. Now, you're in freshman philosophy class. I know that sounds like torture, but I won't prolong it, so just stick with it for 2 minutes. Now, the professor says to the class, how many objects do you see in this picture? And everybody says three. So the professor says, look, each chair has four legs, a seat, and a back. Try again. So someone says, oh, I see. Four legs, a seat, and a back is six. Two chairs is 12. Table has a board, and four legs is five. Get on my calculator, 12 and 5, 17. And the professor says, but look, each leg is made of molecules. And the seat and the back are made of molecules also. So then the student says, then there are, billions or trillions. And the professor says, but look, each molecule is made of atoms. And each atom is made of particles. And some of the particles are made of quarks. Now, if the professor is very lucky, a student will say, but then there isn't a right answer to how many objects there are in the room. It depends upon how you count objects. And that's true, and it's profound, but it's not what I'm interested in. What I'm interested in is this. If you could count as many ways as you like, how come everyone will say three? No one will dream of 17, and no one will say it's billions because of molecules. The answer is because we count objects functionally. We count them by what they do. A chair is for sitting on. You could sit on one chair without the other chair. That's why it's another one. Whereas if you take away one of the legs or the seat in the back, it's going to be hard to sit on that chair. You've compromised its function. That's why it's parts of one. We count by function. Now, to say that husband and wife share a single eye means they function as one. They function as one. Even though they may be doing a lot of different things, they function as one. Imagine a basketball player making a jump shot. So his legs are pulling him off the floor, and his eyes are focusing on the basket, and his hands are throwing the ball. The arms and the legs are not doing the same thing. The eyes and the arms and the legs are not doing the same thing. They're doing different things. But they function as one to make the basket. This is what we're talking about. Functional unity between husband and wife. Let me take a single example through all three levels, and that probably will get the levels crystal clear, I hope. And I'll give you some other illustrations. My wife is a social worker. Actually, she is a social worker. The following didn't happen, but it could have happened. Let's say she comes home one day and she says to me, I'm in trouble. I have this client. and he's going to pieces. And I'm trying to get him to go to a psychologist, and he refuses to go, and he's deteriorating, he might commit suicide. I just don't know what to do. Suppose I listen to her, I sympathize with her, suppose I even offer her a suggestion, goes back to work the next day, comes home, she's overjoyed, she made the appointment, he agreed to go to the psychologist, and she now has hope that he will improve. How should we analyze this little interaction between my wife and me on each of the three levels? Well, if we're on the first level of I plus I could say now, listen, I listened to her, and I offered a suggestion, I sympathized with her, she owes me. She owes me. I'm in the black, she's in the red, I can ask her for steak for supper. she got for her, it's my turn to get for me. That's the I plus I, the Ayn Rand marriage. On a we level, I care as much about her success as she does. But still, we are two, not one, playing different roles. In this case, she's playing the role of principal, and I'm playing the role of enabler. If it's the single eye relationship, then the fact that it was her vocal cords vibrating that set up the sound waves in the air, that beat against the eardrums of her client, that set up the neural impulses in his brain that led to his decision to go to the psychologist, the fact that it was her vocal cords is as little significant as one part of the body making the eye or another part of the body making the eye. I am as identified with her success as she is, because we're part of the same entity that is operating. No matter that she was there and I was someplace else, it's one entity operating in different ways, integratively, to produce a single result. That's what we're talking about in functional integration, in sharing the single eye. That's what Adam had by his creation, his, her, its creation. And that's what we have to try to approximate in marriage. Now, this gives us, I think, a diagnosis of a large part of what's wrong with today's marriages. Because this kind of integration doesn't happen accidentally. You don't get it for free. Here you require a very nasty little four-letter word. Work. And I think that this is the single most deleterious, single most damaging element in today's thinking about marriage. That love in marriage happens all by itself. It's an accident. And either you're lucky and you get it, or you're unlucky and you don't. How do we describe the onset of love in English? We fall in love, right? Sort of like falling in a hole. It's just sort of something that happens, you know. You don't plan to fall, you only fall by accident. How do we describe the cessation of love? We fall out of love. Notice the inconsistency. Can you fall up out of the hole? It doesn't matter. You fall in and you fall out. It's all falling. It's all something that happens to you by accident, not something that you create. Not something that you can take responsibility for. It's the fate of the gods. It has nothing to do with us. That is the single most destructive element in thinking about marriage. That it's going to happen by itself. I saw a statistic on three occasions. They took people who lived together before marriage and then traced, after the ones who got married afterwards, they traced their divorce statistics to see how they would compare with the general population. In the first two occasions, the divorce statistics were equal, and in the third occasion, the divorce statistics for those who lived together before marriage were worse than those in the general population. Now that's a bit surprising. You would imagine that by living together, you could weed out certain incompatibilities, so that when you've lived together for a few years with someone, you decide to get married, you have a better chance of surviving as a marriage. Why should it be no better and perhaps even worse? I think we have the answer. What is the mental set of people who live together? The mental set, the basic attitude is, each one of us has one foot out the door. Nothing ties me down. Nothing compels me. I'm ready to leave whenever I want. That's why I didn't get married. So I can go when I want. I'm a free spirit. I stay as long as I feel like it, and I leave when I don't feel like it. Good. Now let's suppose a problem arises. A sticky problem. And you know from experience this is going to cost a couple of months of grief to sort it out. So you say, why go through the grief? That's why I didn't get married. So I wouldn't be saddled with this kind of grief. I'll go. I'm young. I'm good looking. I have resources. I'll get another one. And another one. And another one. And so will she. She'll also get another one. And another one. I heard an interview in New York with a woman living with her boyfriend for 3 months. The interviewer asked her, what does your boyfriend's father do for a living? And she said, I don't know. The interviewer said, you're living with this fellow for 3 months and you don't know? She said, yeah, we're living together, but we don't know each other that well. What does one thing have to do with the other? Just no regular relationship. Now, people say, of course, Rabbi, we realize that these relationships really are very superficial and they're not very meaningful, there's not no real commitment. But we're 22. We're not planning to get married until we're 35 or 38. And in the meantime, we're having these superficial relationships. But listen, Rabbi, I'm taping your lecture. And when I get there, I'll definitely take it into account. And we'll review it, you know, we'll listen to it together. There's still a lot of tape machines in those days. And electricity hasn't run out. And we'll take it to heart. And we'll use all of your advice. Now, here's the kicker. After 10 or 15 years of superficial relationships, you build up certain habits. You build up certain responses. You build up certain expectations. And 10 or 15 years later, you can't snap your fingers and become a different person. You have crippled yourself in your ability to sustain a committed relationship. Rabbi Schiller, who, if you haven't met him, you'll meet him on the trip to Tzfas in Yetzer Hashem. Schiller has a wonderful, wonderful model for this and other related things. In the laws of warfare, Jewish laws of warfare, there is an opinion that if you are besieging a city, you must not surround it from all four sides. You should only surround it from three sides. And that gives up an advantage. If you surround it from four sides, no supplies can get in and no communication can get out. Why would you give up the fourth side? So, one explanation is this. If you surround the city from all four sides, the defender knows it's fight or die. And therefore he will fight with everything he has. But if you leave the fourth side open, he's got another option. He can always run. So at every moment in the battle, he's thinking to himself, is it time to run yet? Is it time to run yet? That's what you want. You want him thinking like that. You want him distracted. You want him thinking about covering this trail and getting out. And in that way, you're much more likely to take the city. Same thing is true in a relationship. In a live-together relationship, the doors are open. So when there's a problem, the chances are you run. When you're married, there is a tremendous negative pressure not to run. There's a tremendous loss if you run. So there's a tremendous motivation to work the problems out. And that's where you build the relationship and you strengthen the relationship rather than run. You end up with a life full of run. This is the second idea. The extent to which you succeed in building a functionally integrated relationship is the extent to which you are going to feel love in marriage. Now, let me give you a couple of practical applications of this idea. And then, as I said, I'll stop and take questions. Imagine the following scenario. You come home to your significant other, as they call them today, but to make no commitments whatsoever. And the person says to you, do you know what happened to me today? And launches into a description. And you think to yourself, oh no, not again. This happens so often. I get this harangue over and over again. Okay, it's not. She went to it. But it's so boring to listen to this. Must I really listen to this over and over again? Now, there are two schools of thought in marriage counseling about this problem. One school of thought is marriage has to be based on loving kindness, care, sympathy, support. Okay, it's boring. Listen anyway. The person needs it. The other school of thought is marriage has to be based on open, frank, honest communication. Phyllis, I can't take this. It's driving me around the bend, and if I build up frustration here, it'll spill over in other areas. Keep it to yourself. I don't want to hear this. Both miss the point. Both miss the point. The point is this. You're not listening to the story. You're listening to the person. I need to know where my wife is. What's happening in her life? What is she feeling? What is she happy about? What is she unhappy about? And the fact that the story I get now is the same story that I got 2 months ago, and 5 months ago, and 11 months ago, and 13 months ago, and 17 months ago, and 23 months ago, has nothing to do with knowing what it is now. Because I have to relate to her now, because I have to build a relationship now. And therefore, it's very important for me to listen to it. The fact that it's similar to what happened before is irrelevant. Imagine that you have a thermometer outside your bedroom window. You get up in the morning, you look at the temperature and plan your day. Imagine you get up and you say, 70 degrees Fahrenheit. This is 4 mornings in a row. Tomorrow, I'm not going to look. That would be dumb. Because tomorrow, you need to know tomorrow's temperature. What difference does it make if it's been the same for 4 days? So that's the first idea. If you're looking to build an integration, then you need to know where the other person is. And that means whether it's the same or different from what was before, constantly plugging in, constantly renewing, updating. Someone asked Moshe Feinstein, a businessman, said, you know, my wife wants me to call her every day for business. You know what business is like. It's very busy, and it's nerve-wracking. I have to take out every... How can I explain to her that it's unreasonable to ask me to call her every day? So Moshe said, Moshe Feinstein was maybe the greatest single decisor of law at his time, you know, all these Jewish people. He got telephone calls and letters from all over, and delegations from all over the world. And he said, I don't know what you're talking about. I call the Rebbetzin every day. Said, of course you call. That's the ABCs. You know, you don't call. You have to call. That's one idea. Here's another idea, based on Dessler, a very deep and important idea. It has been said that it is easier to give than to receive. Easier to give than to receive. I think this is true, and I think I can prove it. Let's suppose that someone asks you for a loan of $50. Now, you have the $50, and this person is reliable. How hard would it be for you to lend $50? If you're like most people, if you have it, it's not too terribly difficult. Now, switch places. You need to borrow the money. The person you're asking has it, and you're reliable. Which is easier for you, to lend the money or to ask someone else to lend you the money? Because like most people, it's much easier to lend it than to ask for it. So it's easier to give than to receive. Now why? This also I don't think is too deep. Think what lending means. If I lend money, it means I have enough for myself. I'm a success. I've provided for myself. I even have a surplus. And I'm generous. Not a bad return on a $50 investment, and I'm getting the money back. I'm only lending it, right? Whereas if I have to borrow money, it means I'm a failure. I have not provided for myself. I'm needy. Dependent. Than which there is no worse curse. So the ego implications of giving and receiving explain why it's easier to give than to receive. Okay, now here comes the twist. And here you have to listen carefully. If giving is easier than receiving, because giving builds your ego, and receiving attacks your ego, then you need to provide an opportunity for your spouse to give to you. You have to be prepared to receive from your spouse. There has to be a balance between giving and receiving, which means you have to be prepared to receive. This may sound strange to have to stress this, because we have been accused of being a very selfish generation. But sometimes giving is pure selfishness. And receiving is the pure altruism. For example, sometimes when there are marriage problems, one spouse will say, "Do you know what I sacrificed for my spouse? I've given my spouse my love, my time, my effort, my thought, my sleepless nights, my service, my money." And my spouse still isn't satisfied. What more could he or she want? The answer may be that he or she does not want to feel like a fifth wheel. You know what a fifth wheel is? A car needs only four wheels, right? So a fifth wheel is something which doesn't spin and doesn't do any job. It just sits there for nothing. Because in this giving of time, effort, money, sleepless nights, love, concern, sensitivity, what the giver is really doing is protecting his or her ego. Yes, I am strong. Yes, I am successful. Yes, I am great. Yes, I can give. Yes, I can support. Without ever giving the other party the opportunity to feel the same thing. Here's a brutal illustration. It has been said that there are three precious words in the English language which are underused. I love you. That's true. But there's another three words which are not underused, they're never used. And they are, I need you. Think the last time you said that to anyone. I need you. But that's devastating. If I need you, then it means I really can't stand on my own. Well, that's true. No one can stand on his own. We have this deadly illusion. We say in English, the self-made man. I always wanted to ask one of these people, did you sew your own clothes? Did you build your own automobile? Manufacture your own pencils? Did you never borrow money from the bank? Self-made man. What a piece of foolishness. But we say it. We tell a child who's growing up, stand on your own 2 feet. Why? Why? Should he really go through life alone? Shall he never borrow money from the bank? But we have this illusion. I need you is simply a truth. I cannot make it through life. Certainly cannot make successfully through life without you. But when I say that, I'm giving the other person the opportunity to be the giver. And it's hard. But it must be done. There has to be a balance between giving and receiving in a relationship. Husband and wife have a fight. So one says, there's a fight. It was a nasty fight, but I have forgiven. I have totally forgiven. And my spouse knows that when I forgive, 2 weeks later, I won't even remember it. Since I have totally forgiven, why is my spouse still upset? What's bothering my spouse if I've totally forgiven? Now listen, a little piece of logic. If A forgives B, what does that imply about B? That B is guilty! Isn't A generous? Look how generous A is! A is prepared to forgive! How about A asking for forgiveness? Oh no, not me! I was wrong! Why should I ask forgiveness? She's wrong! So when you forgive, you're not giving, you're taking. When you forgive, you're protecting your ego. When you ask for forgiveness, you're giving the other person the opportunity to be magnanimous and give. You have to be prepared to receive. Here, the psychological, and what we would call the Yetzirah, implications are very tricky. What looks like giving is really taking. It's not really giving. And when you're prepared to receive, that's the biggest gift that you can give to the other person. One more thought, or maybe two, and then I'll quit. Most of you are going to make the decision to get married, whom to marry in the next few years. Some 5 or 6 or 7 years. It is almost universal So when you start thinking about marriage, you make out a wish list. All the things I would wish my spouse to have. And it's a good idea, because that way you know what you gave up on. Because nobody gets everything that My wife says, and I must tell you, I owe 80% or more of what I'm telling you tonight to her. It's really her material. I'm just speaking for her. I don't mean that as a joke. I mean that seriously. My wife says that in addition to a wish list, every person ought to have a give list. What can I promote in another person? What can I build in another person? What can I support in another person? Then, when you meet up with a prospective partner, you match across. You see whether your wish list matches her give list, and your give list matches her wish list. And if they do, you have an integrated possibility for an integrated relationship. Because, suppose you meet a woman who has everything on your wish list, down the line, every last quality, and for some unaccountable reason she's interested in you. But she doesn't need you for anything. Would you be happy in that relationship? Not at all. We used to say in English, everyone needs to be needed. That's a great statement. That's a great statement for marriage. It's a great statement for retirement, the dangers of retirement. Everyone needs to be needed. But if so, you must give your spouse the feeling that she's needed. And the only way you can do that is to show her that you need her, which means to be prepared to receive from her. So when you set out, make out the two lists and make sure that they're balanced. One last remark, and as I said, then I'm going to close it. I heard an interview with the sociologist in America about 10 years ago. This sociologist has spent 2 years traveling the length and breadth of the United States investigating happy marriages to see what makes them work. And she had results. She had a theory, which she said explained all of her experiences in 2 years. One factor, she said, only one factor counts. This factor alone determines whether the marriage is happy and the extent to which it's happy. So I'm listening, you know, with both ears. What could it be? She says, similarity between husband and wife. The more similar they are, the happier the marriage will be. Similarity in everything. Politics, shoe size, decorating preferences and colors, plant preferences, time of going to sleep, time of waking up in the morning. The more similarities, the happier the marriage will be. I was flabbergasted. What kind of thing is that? What kind of explanation is that? Why would that be the rule? But it occurred to me after some thinking that it fits into the principle that I'm telling you like gold. Because every difference between two people will cause breakdowns in communication and cooperation. That's inevitable. If you see things differently, respond to things differently, evaluate things differently, interpret things differently, there'll be times when you don't understand one another and times when you respond to the same thing in different ways. Every difference causes a breakdown of these types. If you are passive vis-a-vis success in marriage, if you expect it to happen by itself, these things are going to be irritants. And if there are too many irritants, it becomes insupportable. If you have more similarities, then you respond in the same way, interpret in the same way, feel in the same way, cooperate naturally, and there'll be more happiness in the marriage. But if you are committed to working on the marriage, which is only a minority, then the prediction is different. The similarities build the cement and holds the marriage together. The differences are the stimuli to grow and develop. You build your own similarities by coming to learn and share with and from each other. When we got married, my picture of Gehenna was an art museum. My parents, Elaine and myself, tried valiantly to get me interested in art, but the worst possible thing to do on a Sunday afternoon, even worse than being boiled in oil, was to go to Rock Museum. To me, it was absolutely meaningless. My wife taught me how to appreciate art, and through that, how to appreciate certain aspects of nature. What I have from that, and have had from that for decades, is incalculable. It's incalculable. I gave her some sensitivity to music. When we got married, in these respects, we were very different from one another. But we've become much more similar. Because we saw marriage as a project, not as a product already finished to be enjoyed, but a project to be worked on. So there has to be a balance between the cement that holds it together and the differences which are challenges to growth. And here I'll give you a piece of advice. If you have any doubts, vote for cement. Because the marriages are really under great stress today. And there's so much failure. If you have any, don't be a hero. Oh, me, 2% cement, 98% differences for great growth. I wouldn't recommend it. I wouldn't recommend it. Other heroes have gone down the drain. Also, vote for cement, and this applies to cross-cultural marriages. Cross-cultural marriages are very dangerous. Especially if one is a South African. Those are my friends in South Africa. Right? Any cross-cultural, even Baal Tshuva to someone who came from a religious home, is also cross-cultural. It's dangerous. It can work, but it's dangerous. Because there's so many differences. So many differences in perception. So many differences in reaction. We had one fellow here who married into a full family. And about 18 months after the marriage, the wife came to me and said, I discovered a terrible secret about my husband. I don't know what to do. I don't know the marriage, the family. So I'm thinking, my God, the guy's on drugs. You know, the guy's running guns to the Palestinians. Well, what could he be doing? She found out that when he was in high school, he had a non-Jewish friend, another man. And he actually kept up correspondence with this fellow. Could you imagine? After he came through, he kept up correspondence. And he said to him, if you're ever in Israel, come visit us. And she was horrified. And he thought, my gosh, you know, so what? You know, can't you have a friend that's not Jewish? That's just because they came from different backgrounds, different cultural settings. And to her, it was shocking. So this is what you're courting if you marry across cultures. So be very careful about that. To put everything I said tonight into an aphorism, I would put it this way. People make a great effort when they're going to get married to make the right choice. Find the person who's the right choice. I think more important than making the right choice is the commitment to make the choice right. That means after you've made the choice, to work to make it right. Because if you put all your effort into making the right choice, then your attitude is this. My effort, my analysis, my investment is in finding the right person. But after that, it's fate. Either the love comes or it doesn't come. That's poison. That's back to the American model. That's poison. No, the commitment has to be to make the choice right. That after the choice has been made, to work to make it right. Questions? Only after you're married.